Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week from the Grenfell Tower Action Group, it's Joe Delaney. And the first part of several parts of his story, the latest from Grenfell Tower. Then Liz Crowther, she played Sonia in the Shoestring series, which has just been released for the first time. Complete two series of Shoestring on DVD. And then Matthew Carey from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is organising a meeting to look at the alternatives to the cuts across Bristol. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you the contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Joe Delaney. I'm a resident of the Lancaster West Estate, in which Grenfell Tower is based. I was based on a block physically attached to Grenfell Tower called Barrandon Walk. I've been evacuated to a hotel in Hammersmith, 2 miles away, since roughly 10 days after the fire. I'm currently on the council's Grenfell Recovery Scrutiny Committee as a co-opted member. And I'm also on the Lancaster West Residents Association Committee.
The main question's got to be, you know, what has the council done to rehouse people? Because I think, you know, this long after it, we're still hearing that some people have not been properly looked after.
Yes, it's a sad fact that 75%, I believe, of the people who need to be rehomed have not been rehomed as yet. The council keep talking about these 300 properties that they've acquired. And I know from my work on the scrutiny committee that they haven't exchanged contracts on those properties yet. And as anyone in sort of, you know, any estate agent will tell you, it takes at least 6 months for a house sale to actually go through to completion. And so many of these properties aren't going to become available until February, March, April, May. Because of the time when the council actually purchased them. It's the same with this much touted posh block that everyone keeps talking about, Kensington Row. Most of the properties that are in there are either not available yet for people to occupy, and the ones that are available aren't of the correct size to house the families from the tower who are being given priority at the moment. So it's an absolute ridiculous farce down here at the minute. A supposed flagship four-star audited council, one of the Tory flagship councils in the country, one that was often held up as a model for other councils to emulate, just cannot get its act together on this matter. And as I've said since the start, Kensington and Chelsea's attitude has been to manage a PR disaster. They are not managing the humanitarian one, which began on the night of that fire, and they are continuing to exacerbate at the moment with their inaction and ineptitude.
It sounds to me like you're saying that the Kensington and Chelsea Council are more interested in how Grenfell is being spun to the outside world than actually making sure that those people who survived it are being looked after.
Let me give you an example. There is a helpline, a housing helpline that people could ring in the immediate aftermath of the fire. And this is for people such as myself who'd been evacuated from their properties and were told to ring this number in order to obtain accommodation. You rang that number and basically it was either engaged or it rang out. You rang their press office, it was always answered within four rings. The one team at the council at the moment that they've recruited for, they've just recruited 10 more communications operatives, as they're known. So yes, their Twitter feed and their Facebook page, you know, and their Instagram, they all look wonderful. And it looks like, you know, they've got lots done and they're getting lots more to do. But frankly, as I've said, it is literally just them trying to spin a message. And the more they try and spin that message, the more people such as myself are determined to see that it unravels before them. Because it is outrageous that they are still treating this as a PR matter rather than a humanitarian one.
Many people have died. I think, isn't it, just over 80 people died in the fire. Can you just give us a sense of the kind of humanitarian side of this? And I mean, I don't want to be too trite and say, you know, how do you feel or anything like that, but this must have had an enormous effect on the local community.
The official death toll at the moment stands at 71. However, there are some issues around the methodology that the police have used to calculate that figure. And also, the tower is still being looked through by forensic teams at the moment. So if they were so sure of that figure, I fail to see why they've got the men in white suits still continuing to comb the place with such meticulousness. I really do hope that the figure is nearer 71 than 100 or 150, which is basically what most locals were estimating to be in there. But, I mean, we probably never will know for sure. It's estimated that at times that block was burning at temperatures between 1600 and 1900 degrees Celsius. And to give you an idea, a crematorium burns at 1600. So, you know, there is a fair chance that some people's remains will never be recovered. Of the deaths, I did know quite a few people who were in there. And something which isn't mentioned that often, I also knew quite a lot of the pets, being a dog owner myself. So it's often the case when you're out with your dogs, you'll know the names of the other people's dogs, but you wouldn't know the names of the people. And there were quite a few like that I would just sort of chat to, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And I know that they're dead for a fact because, you know, they're just not around anymore. And it's been since the tragedy that I actually got to know some of their names. But I do think that, that's one of the things that really struck with me since then. It's just the sheer amount of sort of related deaths that people aren't even thinking of in that respect. You know, people's pets died that night, as well as, you know, people's lives burned, and basically, you know, everything to do with their life. They lost all their memories, you know, photos. They lost what, you know, documents they had, what mementos their family may have given them, what heirlooms there may have been in their families as well. So, I mean, on top of the human tragedies, you know, that there are all these little sufferings which people have experienced, you know, and you see that in a lot of the survivors now. You know, they almost feel guilty about talking about something like their pet dying, you know, when I'm sure it's just as much of a tragedy to them that their pets died. And it's this sort of the fact that there is so much suffering still going on. People often feel guilty about even speaking about such matters like that. They don't feel it's their place just yet. You see, and it just shows me that there's an enormous amount of tact and dignity in the local community that just seems sorely lacking in the authorities. And that's one of the things that really got to me at the very, from the very beginning, was this fact. I mean, all of these, you know, all of these organizations, the council, the government, and things like that, they're staffed by human beings. But it seems that when they're part of these institutions, their ability to relate to other people on a simple human level just goes out the window.
Well, look, nobody wants to point the finger at the fire brigade, but there are a few things that one does wonder about, which one, the first or most obvious of which is this advice that was given for certainly for an hour or so into the fire
to stay put policy.
And also, I mean, one of the things that many people looking at that fire and the aftermath on the 14th of June 2016 were saying, certainly that I spoke to, was what about the old-fashioned way where people can jump out and there's a kind of bunch of firemen at the bottom holding something that they can jump into, a kind of you know, so that at least that they can catch people.
I was there that night, and I can tell, I mean, the stay put policy makes sense if the building was properly fire rated. Because the way that tower blocks are supposed to be designed under current building regulations, you know, even as appalling as they are, is that a flat in a tower block is supposed to be able to sustain a fire for 60 minutes. And the stay put policy that the fire brigade have, what they basically do when they go into a tower block such as that is they will make their way up and they will tell everyone on each floor to assemble in one property on that particular floor. And then on their way down, they know which flat to go to get everyone out. And they will get them out in stages like that so that basically you don't end up with a crush on the emergency staircase, especially in a building like Grenfell when there was only one emergency staircase for everyone to use. And it was shrouded in smoke because the first part of the building that went up was actually the exterior along where the emergency staircase was because that was where the gas pipes had been fitted. Because it was cheaper to fit them along there than it was to sort of embed them in the building. When it comes to the fire service, I mean, I saw their work that night. And to be honest, I cannot fault them. They physically couldn't get near the building at first because the cladding was burning. When the cladding burned, basically, the noise that I can equate it to most is, you know, the sound of popcorn in a microwave when it starts to pop. You could just hear that noise continually. It was like that on a massive scale. And literally parts of the cladding were popping off the sides of the building and showering down. So there was this sort of shower of red hot debris that was hitting all around the base of the tower. And it was physically preventing the firemen from getting near. What they actually ended up doing was they ended up borrowing riot shields from the police and were using those as sort of makeshift umbrellas to cover their heads. And I mean, I saw the firemen when they got into that building. There were some of them who didn't have breathing equipment on. There were some of them who didn't even have masks. They were just that keen to get in there. And I've spoken to quite a few of the firemen since the event. And believe me, it's of all of the institutions that I have seen, the one that has shown the most humanity and the one it seems to have had the most profound effect on its staff of has been the fire brigade. They do feel guilty about what happened that night because they had faith that the building was properly regulated and maintained. And so therefore they thought the advice they were giving was sound. You know, and unfortunately, that proved not to be the case.
What about the potential, as some people have commented, of actually being able to kind of get a helicopter onto the roof and take people off of the roof and get people out that way? I mean, that must have been surely an alternative to everybody having to stay put in an inferno.
Well, I mean, the issue there would probably be a logistical one. I mean, from what I've been told, if they'd have brought, if a helicopter had been brought too close to the building, there was a risk that it could cause either a backdraft of the flames because of the shear from the rotors, or that it could have caused more harm to people. Because if for a start, people couldn't get out onto the roof because the roof access was sealed off. So even if they had got out there, I mean, if 100 people are on that roof and you just put down one rope, you know, what kind of chaos could have ensued in that case? You know, I mean, you could have ended up with a helicopter crashing there as well. I mean, when you see these things in Hollywood, it certainly looks a lot easier. But I mean, even if you look at the way forest fires and such are tackled, it's very, very rare that you'll see them actually try and mount an air rescue in any circumstance because of those inherent risks. You know, the last thing you want to do is now introduce a whole load of, aviation fuel and a crashed helicopter into what's already a disaster zone. So I do think there were issues as well. And also, because of all the cuts to the fire service, you know, I doubt we have such equipment in this country to be able to even mount that kind of operation if it had been wanted. Really an impossible choice.
What you said about the breathing apparatus, I mean, that does shock and surprise me that firefighters didn't have enough breathing apparatus for them all. I mean, that have they brought that up as an issue? Because this is a basic thing.
I think what it was at the time was that basically some of them were downstairs and were trying to sort of hose things and stuff like that. And so then the minute they could get access to the building, all of the ones who were in the vicinity just basically piled in. You know, so I'm not sure on what the numbers for breathing apparatus was. I mean, I'd certainly hope that there is enough equipment, you know, so that it's, you know, one fireman, one mask, or whatever the term would be. I'd certainly hope that there was enough. But what I was trying to show there was when they did actually get the opportunity, it's like, look, we've made this passage now using riot shields and things that we can get in. All of the ones who were in the vicinity just rushed in at that point because they were so desperate to try and save people.
That was Joe Delaney from the Grenfell Action Group.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Liz Crowther, and 40 years ago, I started filming a teleseries called Shoestring, which I never believed would be such a sort of cult hit, and they've just re-released it on DVD, and I watched some of it, which was a strange experience. It was one of the first tellies I ever did as an adult, although I'd played Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe on black and white telly when I was 12 and done various other things.
Tell us a bit about how you got into acting.
How I got into acting was, my family were actors. My darling mum was a dancer and actress, and my dad was Leslie Crowther, who had worked in theatre. He and my mum met at Arts Educational Drama School, where I went as well, and they were part of the Ovaltinis, which was a radio, young people sort of radio sketch show, as far as I know, and singing and review sort of type show. And my dad then did Crackerjack when I was little. And then I went to ballet school, where they also taught drama and got picked to play Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And I also danced in the Nutcracker with the festival ballet that they used to do a performance of it every Christmas at the Festival Hall in London. And my school provided the kids. So we had great training, but I'd also spent, you know, years in the wings and years. I spent about 5 years on tour with my dad doing this mad show called The Folderols, which was a sketch show, fast moving, singing, dancing, comedy sketch show that he was a leading light in. So I'd grown up with theatre and then wanted to be a ballet dancer, but didn't quite have what it required. And then got more interested in acting, which is a longer lasting career. I couldn't still be a ballet dancer at 63, probably. Most of them finish in their 40s. So I'm very glad that I moved into acting.
Was it easy enough to get this part in Shoestring?
In Shoestring, I think my stroke of luck was the fact that I was doing a play by Václav Havel, who was then in prison, I think, a Czechoslovakian playwright, who then went on to become the president of Czechoslovakia, and who I actually met 30 years after doing the play. And in the play, I was playing a secretary, which I also played in Shoestring. I was sort of on the front desk, if anybody hasn't seen it, a receptionist. And I played exactly the same thing in The Memorandum, this amazing play. And because it was in the round in a theatre called the Orange Tree in Richmond, I had to touch type and look like I knew what I was doing. So I did learn to type several sentences. I taught myself so that if people looked over my shoulder, I wouldn't be just typing gobbledygook, you know, gobbledygook, that's the word, yes. Good, I'm performing tonight. So the producers came to see that play. And then I went up for an interview and they said they'd seen me in a couple of things there and wanted to employ me as Sonia.
It sounds quite interesting, the idea that an imprisoned, later to become president of Czechoslovakia, has written it. What was the play about?
It was about the bureaucracy that you had to employ to live under a very severe communist regime. So in this office, they'd actually invented a new language. Bureaucrats had invented a new language, which is called Pedidopy, where you said exaptazar najex, and there were 17 ways of saying boo. It kind of mirrored all the other ways that you had to operate in those societies. Tom Stoppard who's also a Czech born man and is the same age as Havel, who's sadly now died, Václav Havel. Although I shook his hand, which was one of the best moments of my life. And all these writers, they did very difficult things, like they would not let their children have university education, or Havel himself was employed as in a brewery. That's how they kind of made them do other work rather than having their plays produced. And so Havel actually wrote his first play about working in a brewery, and it had an autobiographical character called Vaněk. And 30 years later, Tom Stoppard and all of the Orange Reactors, we actually marched to the Czech embassy in 1977 because there was this amazing charter called Charter 77, which was to demand free speech for artists and for you know, dissidents in Czechoslovakia. And they actually won. They got the right to free speech. At this, the 30th anniversary of this, at the Orange Tree Theatre, which Václav Havel was present at, they performed some of his play, this play set in a brewery, in Czech, with translations for those few of us that were in the audience who weren't Czech. And Havel himself read his character, walked on the stage. It was one of the most magnificent moments of my life.
Let's go on to talk about Shoestring. The release of it, start almost at the other end in a way. It's taken 40 years to actually get it released on DVD. It seems, I think it may have been out one or two episodes on VHS many years ago. But why? Any idea why it's taken such a long time?
Some of the first series was put out on DVD, but this is the first time the whole series has been put out. And there's an accompanying booklet which talks about, well, it publishes all the casts, because there were some amazing people in it. Sharma MacDonald, the playwright, a wonderful playwright, she played a woman in a refuge in one of the episodes. There were all sorts of incredible people. Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, had a small role in it. He played a DJ. There were lots of incredible people in it, and lots of writers and directors who then went on to do extraordinary things. Marek Kanievska, who went on to direct Another Country, Martin Friend, Ben Bolt, as well as Trevor, sort of, you know, rocketing to stardom. We filmed it at Ealing Studios, which was where all the Passport to Pimlico, all the Ealing comedies had been filmed. And I think we were actually, the office was actually in the above the tank where they'd filmed The Cruel Sea in the sort of, I think it was the 1940s. So it was incredible. And then, of course, all the location stuff was filmed in Bristol, right near the Old Vic, which is where I'm going to be performing in a few weeks.
It talks in the programme, it talks about Radio West, and it starts, I think, very strong, the series, because Trevor Eve, who's this radio detective, finds himself investigating somebody on his own radio station.
I know there was one where somebody who worked there then went off and committed a lot of crimes against women, and I was heavily involved in one of those episodes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I don't know whether that was the first episode?
Yeah, it was the first episode is where the presenter, presenter on Radio West is going to see a prostitute that then gets into trouble and tries to contact him on a phone-in, you know, but he wants nothing to do with her and she ends up dead. So it's quite a powerful, I suppose, introduction between the detective and the radio station.
Yes. I think there were lots of excellent factors, like the fact that Eddie Shoestring had had a kind of nervous breakdown. He'd also worked in computers. So he was a more sensitive soul. And, of course, computers were just very embryonic at that stage. I think we see him in one shot. I've watched a whole slew of them, so that's why I get confused about some of them. But you see an entire room, you know, like all full of computers, but like all the, you know, how they used to be. It's nothing. It's like this laptop that I'm speaking to you on is it's an entire room full of hardware. It's hilarious.
What about, he's an IT casualty. Is he, do you think, television's first IT casualty character?
Perhaps, yes, indeed. And maybe, I'm not terribly au fait with loads of other detectives, but I think, I don't know how many of them have had sort of mental health problems either. Can you remember any others?
I can't. I can't. But I just thought it was. It was almost well ahead of its time, wasn't it? I mean, he was somebody who'd been working in IT, but just couldn't take it and had a breakdown.
Yes. And it was forward thinking in so many other ways. You know, the story about the women's refuge. There was a wonderful story where the actress Sandy Ratcliffe, who'd been in Ken Loach's film about a family. Oh, anyway, she was absolutely brilliant actress, and she was being an activist by threatening to jump off the roof, complaining about her husband in prison. So there were lots of, there were punk rockers, there was, Toya Wilcox was in an episode. There were a lot of extraordinary storylines, as well as the things that you, when I really watched quite a lot of them recently, which is probably why I got them muddled up, lots of hilarious things like everybody smoking, people just getting out of their cars and not dreaming of locking them, people not wearing seatbelts, grass verges in the middle of motorways, sort of strange sexy calendars in people's offices that, you know, you really think, well, just wouldn't really happen now. Lots of things like that. But it's, yes, it, but at the same time, these very new ideas and quite... Trevor definitely introduced a modern style of acting. Doran Godwin, who played his lover, was a lawyer, so she was a very strong female character. Michael Medwin, who is the other regular along with me, was also a very as an actor, he'd been probably filmed a lot at the Ealing Studios himself, but he had a production company with Albert Finney. It was a very small but quite unusual cast, maybe.
Actually getting these things into production? Because obviously, you've got to have a kind of little boiler house there, churning these scripts out to get everything. And you've got to get those scripts beforehand. Did that all work out okay, or were there any times where you were finding you were only getting scripts at the last minute?
Oh no, I mean, compared to nowadays where you're due to shoot a scene and it's sort of 11 o'clock at night, or goodness knows what time at night, you might get, you know, rewritten pages which you have to, you know by the next day. No, I think as far as I remember we took, I think, 3 weeks to shoot an episode, and that was an hour-long episode. I don't know how long. Maybe things like Happy Valley or some of those Broadchurch, some of those, top-notch dramas, maybe they take that length of time, I'm not sure. But we certainly had the luxury of a good amount of time to film. Trevor tweaked with some of the scripts. I think in the booklet I do remember reading that... some of the scripts they had to adapt, but I don't think it was that problem of scripts not being delivered on time. I think it's nowadays where a director will start a show not even knowing where what the location's like. I think that's all changed radically. So I think we were well prepped ahead, as far as I remember.
One of the constant references throughout the series is to this Bristol Mafia, although I don't know if Bristol itself is referenced. Obviously, the whole thing is filmed in Bristol. Almost a city elite that sort of run things from behind the scenes. And I think that also works quite well. I mean, do you think that helped make its popularity? Because that's got a sort of ring of truth to it, where we're now in a situation, I mean, we probably were in the 70s too, where, you know, things are people are making money, but they're not necessarily being called to account for it. And Trevor, with his investigations, was able to do something about that.
Yes. I mean, immediately springs to mind where my mum and dad lived, the pool in Bath, the rooftop pool, with the spring water, and how that ended up costing, you know, 40 million or something. Yes, I think that's, well, I think the 70s were definitely very activist times and very political. So, yes, that probably did connect with a lot of people. Somebody, you know, a slightly sort of appearing to be shambling sort of man, but who is absolutely spot on in actually finding out the truth about things.
Was there an element of the Columbo about it, do you think?
Possibly, yes, possibly. Because that was very much Trevor deciding about his clothes and sort of going for the thin ties, and he wanted the linen suits that were unironed and wanted to look like he'd sort of been, I don't know, finding information or just got out of bed or you know what I mean. It was not a sort of very sharp-suited detective. It was a more I don't know what sort of approach you called it, but it was just very fresh. And with his acting style as well, I think that was, and his charm, you know, his charm. So he would manage to get Erica, his girlfriend, to provide him with all sorts of bits of information. That probably wouldn't be allowed now.
Well, you'd be surprised. What about tales while you were filming? Is there anything you can remember?
I mean, there were some funny things, like Marek Kaniyota suddenly gave me these massive, trendy glasses, and it was like, but I've never worn these before. And so I balked at that a bit, so I ended up wearing them now and again. And I also had to drive down a 1-in-8 hill in one episode, which was quite a big episode for me, where Sonia got attacked. And I'd only just passed my driving test, and that was absolutely terrifying. I had my first experience of fan letters that was unbelievable, some of the things that people wrote. I'm trying to remember. Gosh.
Did you really generate fan mail for you? You weren't like the leading lady, were you?
No, I had the smallest part of everybody. And quite often I didn't get to go to Bristol at all. I would just shoot my few days in Ealing studios. No, it's weird. I don't know why. I got asked to lose weight. That was another thing that would be surprising now. I was asked to lose a stone and a half before we started filming, but I was still reasonably round. Although when I look at it now, I think, goodness me, I mean, you know, how dare they have asked me to lose weight? But So I feel like I blazed a trail for plumper actresses a bit. I seem to remember getting one fan letter that said that I was better than Vivian Leigh, Marilyn Monroe and Hedy Lamarr or something like that. It was just extraordinary. It was like out of all proportion.
Tell us about that. What role you played? Who was this Sonia?
Sonia, she was a switched on Robert Banks Stewart, darling Robert Banks Stewart, who recently died, sadly, the producer. He described me as spiky, a spiky redhead he cast me as. But she just seemed an incredibly nice, bright, helpful woman who happened to spot quite a few things, you know, when she was answering phone calls or seeing people coming in at the reception. She was a decent, hardworking girl. It was a shame that I couldn't be Bristol. But, and in fact, I'm always getting told off for sounding too posh now, but when you look at the series, I actually sound quite a bit posher, which is strange. I think that was just the time, the same way as you look back, you know, because it was blinking 40 years ago when we, you know, filmed the first episode.
Well, it ended up being a very successful series. What do you put that down to?
I think a combination of a lot of things. Like you say, the IT nervous breakdown detective that Trevor played so brilliantly in a kind of the clothes he wore, the music. George Fenton's music was a massive contribution. Bristol, beautiful Bristol, fantastic Bristol. It was a very diverse series, you know, ethnically speaking, and I don't know how common that was, apart from strange sitcoms that you wouldn't want to necessarily see again, like Love Thy Neighbor, you know, in terms of the shocking things that people said, whereas this was much more inclusive in lots of ways. It reflected Bristol. It reflected punk rock. It reflected a great many things that were happening in Bristol, though I don't think had been the centre of, you know, a location so visibly. You know, the pub was on the boat. There were lots of wonderful things to be seen around there. Lots of beautiful countryside, the docks, as well. You know, a great variety of lands, of locations. It felt very young. The stories were good. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you probably got nailed it there. Great stories. Yeah, definitely good stories. And I think this, it was, there was a sort of a half of a 1970s jab at the establishment on, and of course, yes, it was 1979 and 80 where Thatcherism, yeah, was all just starting. It was almost like TV's last jab at the establishment before the Tories took over and Thatcherism started, maybe.
Definitely. And I think that Shoestring, kind of, he was so anti-establishment. And he had a girlfriend who, in Doran Godwin, Zerika Bayliss, who that's the call.
Thank you.
That's my call, because for Passage to India, I've got to go and warm up, I'm afraid. I'm coming to Bristol. I've got to plug this.
Yeah.
In A Passage to India, Bristol Old Vic, January the 30th to February the 3rd, Saturday matinee, a fantastic show. You can see Sonia with grey hair. it's in the beautiful Bristol Old Vic Theatre. It's a wonderful show, set in the Raj, but with all the, again, quite an anti-establishment novel that's turned into a play, so reflects what Shoestring first posited. So I think I have to go and warm up now.
Okay, look, before you do, I'm going to ask you one last question, Liz. Yep. What happened to TV drama? Because it's almost as if we haven't had very much since, you know, and series at the moment, which are like McMafia, which are being touted as amazing. You know, a lot of it is actually quite turgid, difficult to get through, and this was light and so much more attractive.
I blame it all on Thatcher, because when the TV franchises all got broken down, and then all of the BBC had to be producer's choice, and then they started paying some people huge salaries to be in things, and they didn't. It just, I don't know, everything became about stars and, although having said that, I've had a blinking stand-in, so that was that was the first case of that I'd met on telly. But yes, I don't know. And then adverts, the fact that you're not allowed to have something long on television anymore. Everything has to, you know, be bite-sized, has to be over-explained. I don't know. But it was definitely one of a kind.
Just remind us where and when you're on again, please, here in Bristol.
Bristol Old Vic Theatre from January the 30th to February the 3rd, every night at 7:30 with a Saturday matinee in A Passage to India, an absolutely phenomenal novel by E.M. Forster that's been turned into a wonderful ensemble piece of theatre. I play Mrs. Moore, and I also play her youngest son, Ralph. It's a fantastically diverse cast. We have beautiful music by Kuljit Bamra. Come and see it. It's bloody wonderful.
Okay, Liz, we'll let you go then. Thank you. They're probably waiting for you now. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you ever so much, Tony. Take care.
Bye.
Lots of love. Bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hi, I'm Matthew Carey, and I'm the organising secretary of the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, or BADACA for short.
Alternative to cuts, the great Bristol debate. Well, is there really any alternative to the cuts, Matthew?
Yes, we believe there is. The council's got £200 million of usable reserves, and although that wouldn't last forever, they can both delay the cuts at the very least.
I suppose you'll say that the Theresa May's Conservative government isn't going to last forever as well.
Well, that's true, but it will last less long if the Labour Party has a concerted campaign against local authority.
But it has. I mean, it's got many of the core cities have actually said that they are trying to persuade central government anyway not to implement these cuts.
Well, yeah, that's true. They've made statements, but they haven't actually taken any action.
What action could they take?
Well, between them, Labour local authorities have got £9 billion of reserves. They could last for 2 or 3 years, and if it was a mass campaign led by Corbyn, the unions and the council leaders, the Tories would cave in at the mere suggestion of that, you know. So it's really, it's okay to talk anti-austerity, but they need to take action. And I think that it would be the last nail in the coffin of the Tory government.
But there's actually nothing they can really do. I mean, I know you think there might be, but there isn't anything they can do. At the end of the day, there's only a certain amount of money comes from the Treasury to Bristol, yeah, and no more.
No, that's true. But, I mean, they're making, or they're trying to make 30-odd million pounds a year cuts to the budget at the moment. They could plug that gap for the time being. And if a campaign was launched that was effective and was national and was a mass campaign in nature, then they could force the Tories back.
But why don't other left-wingers, not necessarily the Labour Party here in Bristol run by Marvin Rees, why don't other lefties run that campaign and then Marvin Rees might eventually join you?
Well, they do. I mean, I've got comrades all over the country who argue for what we're arguing for. I know we're in a different situation because it's only recently that we've had a Labour administration that, you know, cities like Liverpool or Leeds or Manchester, they've had the Labour Party making cuts since Cameron and Clegg came in 2010. So they're kind of a bit more kind of disillusioned perhaps than we are in Bristol. But the difference now is that the Tories are so weak. You know, Theresa May is not Margaret Thatcher, and this is
the trouble. Yeah, okay, you say that, but she's got her majority with the help of the DUP, yeah, and she's going to probably be there almost certainly until 2020, and that's where the power is, not with Marvin Rees.
Yeah, that's true, but if the Labour Party continues to implement cuts, they will take some of the blame, you know, which is why the Tories do it. It's what they want the Labour Party to take some of the blame for the austerity, and it's damaging Labour's and Jeremy Corbyn's anti-austerity case if they just submit and don't actually put up a fight.
So have you got, I mean, this is billed as a great debate here, yeah, but have you really got both sides in this debate, or is this just the left, the socialists, whatever, talking to themselves?
Well, we've got someone from Momentum come in, and we've been promised a speaker from the Green Party as well, obviously.
But that's all the left, isn't
it? It is on the left. We have invited Marvin Rees, although we haven't heard back from him. But then, you know, we get the other side in the news all the time, you know, that there is no alternative, we have to implement the cuts, you know. It would be illegal to set a balanced budget using reserves, which is simply not true.
So can you give us an idea of, if you were sitting in Marvin's seat, what would you be doing, Matthew?
Well, I would...
Other than, I mean, you've already said, you know, sort of joining up with other cities.
Yeah.
But literally, like, you know, what could you save and what money could you use to do it right now here in Bristol?
Well, as I say, there's £200 million in usable reserves. I mean, some of that is earmarked, but it's not... It would be perfectly feasible. For example, in the current financial year, Marvin used £11 million of the reserves to plug a hole in the budget. They could use more of the reserves to plug a bigger hole in the budget and delay the cuts. And that means, you know, half the public toilets in Bristol will be shut by the end of this month. People don't even realise that. There's all these other cuts coming down the line. If they don't take a stand now, and Theresa May does last until 2022, there'll be nothing left apart from statutory child protection and stuff like that.
Well, that looks like that's the way it's going to go. And all you can do is sort of stamp your feet by the sidelines, Matthew.
Well, that's what we'll have to do then. But I mean, if we can build the campaign and the Tories are demonstrably extremely weak, then they will U-turn on this as they've U-turned on so many other issues since Jeremy Corbyn came in.
Do you have actually any support within the Labour Party? Because you don't seem to have the support of Marvin Rees.
Yes,
the leader.
Do. Yeah, Momentum are speaking in our great debate next Wednesday, and they've put forward a 19-point plan, Bristol Momentum, for how Labour Party can avoid the cuts in Bristol. And while we don't agree with everything, I mean, for example, they do like the idea of the progressive council tax that people have been talking about, where they, where you put the council tax up for the largest houses by 100% or something. So we've got reservations about some of the ideas, but at least they're putting ideas forwards for alternatives to the
Also, apparently, Bristol's businesses have been not paying their business rates, appealing them. There are many millions of pounds has not been paid by Bristol businesses because they think, well, the council is asking them to pay too much. So they've taken the route of appeal rather than pay up.
Right, OK, well, yeah, I'm not sure about the ins and outs of the business rates sort of situation, but hopefully businesses will pay what they're due to pay anyway.
Fingers crossed, eh?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that the businesses, the thing is that they can take those risks because nobody on the board of directors who's making these decisions stands to personally have to pay anything. It's the business that will take the hit, you know, if they send the lawyers in. I just wonder, do you think there's any real chance of a general election between now and 2022? Because a lot of people are, and I wonder if it's not just wishful thinking. Say, oh, Theresa May can't last the course. Possibly after Brexit, there'll be a different leader of the Conservative Party. But it looks as if we're just going to be in the same sort of situation now with the Conservative fragile majority,
yeah,
with a certain amount of money paid for it to the DUP, which some say might be a bribe, by the way,
yeah,
under the Bribery Act. So what do you see as the most likely thing to precipitate a general election?
Well, I think it's probably going to be a combination of things. I mean, the Carillion situation, I think, is going to blow up into a big sort of scandal, and it really exposes the corruption of neoliberalism.
But isn't it going to be a bit like Grenfell Tower? It's in the news for a couple of weeks and then just people forget about it.
Well, it could be, but I think that there's a lot of skeletons in that closet, and I think that it will keep coming back to bite them for quite a while. That's the impression I get. I mean, the whole system of privatisation that's gone on for the last 30 or 40 years is just legalised corruption, basically.
Tell us a bit more then about Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. How often do you meet and have you actually achieved anything?
Well, we meet every sort of month or two, something like that. And we've been going since 2010. We originally sat up by PCS and NUT unions, and we've got various union branches that are affiliated to us. Unite branches, CWU, NUT, PCS. So we're kind of a delegate body. You know, we have trade union representatives and also representatives from other sort of groups and stuff that come to our meetings.
Have you got a leader? Because sometimes rule by committee means that, you know, you just get, becomes a talking shop.
Well, I suppose if anyone's a leader, then I am at the moment. I mean, we have had other leaders in the past. But we try and put a positive sort of program or alternative to the cuts and things that we can do to highlight austerity and to push the Labour Party in this case into putting up more of a fight.
Isn't it a bit like the People's Front of Judea versus the Judean People's Front? Isn't the left wing always divided against themselves? Because you look at the Tory Party, and even though there are fundamental differences with Europe, for example, they tend to just button it, really. They don't they sort their backstabbing out in private rather than in public, which the left seem to do in public.
That is true, but I mean, the last 2 years have been an utter departure, really. I've been involved in the Labour movement since sort of 86. I first joined the Labour Party, Young Socialists, and really the whole period from the mid-90s until the last couple of years, you know, the Labour Party didn't really stand for what I believed in anymore. It wasn't socialist in any sense. But the last couple of years, I mean, it's been a big kind of fight, but Jeremy Corbyn has started to change the Labour Party, and he's brought all these hundreds of thousands of new people in, and it's a completely different situation now. Obviously, you know, we've got differences with the policies that they're pursuing, but the general direction is much more towards a socialist way of looking at things now, which is very positive from our point of view.
A lot of people say Corbyn really couldn't be prime minister material because he's just a bit too much of a hippie. He's a bit too flaky, you know, that he's not enough leadership material.
Well, I think he's got better, you know, since he first came in. I mean, he's, you know, I have my criticisms of him, you know, but he's always been a socialist. I mean, I met him back in the 80s, and he's all the way through that Blair and Brown period, he was on the backbenches pursuing a socialist agenda, which is more than can be said for 95% of Labour MPs.
The trouble is, Matthew, is that socialists don't necessarily understand being able to take on the big institutions in this country, like the City of London and the London media. Socialists, I mean, whereas the Tories do. I mean, they seem to know how to get their way with these big elite institutions.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why we need a mass movement. We need a mass movement to defeat austerity, but we're going to need a mass movement to back Jeremy Corbyn up if he's going to make real changes as the Prime Minister.
What about Carillion? Because they had a lot of people involved in schools and hospitals, didn't they?
Yeah.
I understand quite a lot of contracts here in Bristol. Southmead, for example, Carillion were involved in Southmead Hospital.
Yeah.
And one of the things I heard just before Christmas, actually, was that they were actually not doing anything themselves at Southmead particularly, but what they were doing was subcontracting and then taking a cut of what the subcontractors were being paid by the government. A little 15% or so would just go to Carillion. And it does seem that you've got the similar kind of situation brewing up with big contracts like HS2 and Hinkley C.
Yeah.
Contract fraud even possibly. But anyway, what effect has this Carillion collapse had or going to have, do you think, on our schools and hospitals?
Well, it could be extremely dire if the contracts all collapse and the maintenance isn't done anymore. But, I mean, what we would say, and I think what Jeremy Corbyn would say, is that this should all be renationalised. It should all be brought back in-house. I heard yesterday that there's £250 billion a year being contracted out to companies like Carillion, Capita, Serco, G4S, etc., etc. And that's just leading to public services being hollowed out and public service workers being screwed down for the profit of these private companies.
So who are these people? Serco, Capita, Carillion?
Well, exactly. The whole thing is just taking the responsibility for public services away from government and hiding it behind this commercial confidentiality. It's just corruption. It needs to be called out for what it is. Badaka are organising this debate entitled Alternative to Cuts, the Great Bristol Debate, and it's at 7 p.m. next Wednesday the 24th, and that's at Tony Benn House, 92 Victoria Street, Bristol BS1 6AY. That's the Unite headquarters with the big Unite sign on it.
Okay, so that's on Victoria Street. Next Wednesday, 24th of January at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Matthew Carey from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. You've got a website. It's bristolanticutsalliance.org.uk, and you're on Facebook. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joe Delaney from Grenfell Action Group, Liz Crowther, who acted in Shoestring and is coming to the Bristol Old Vic very soon, and also from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, Matthew Carey. Also to studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
We used to walk two by two, lovers pass, and as they're passing by, I could die, 'cause you're not here with me. Now the trees are bare, there's sadness in the air, and I'm as blue as I can be. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, blue on blue, now that we are through. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, and I find I can't get over losing you. Night after lonely night, we meet in dreams as I run to your side. You wait with open arms that now are closed to me. Through a veil of tears, your vision disappears, and I'm as blue as I can be. Blue on blue, heartache on heartache, now that we are through. Blue on blue, heart.